WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is John Kenneth Galbraith, who for decades has been one of America's most influential liberal economists. Journalist David Halberstam once described Galbraith as an enormous figure who tends to dominate every group, every scene, with a combination of size, intellect, humor, and sheer gall. During his career, Galbraith worked in the Roosevelt administration, served as an advisor and speechwriter for Adlai Stevenson's presidential campaign, and was ambassador to India under Kennedy. His economic theories helped inspire Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, and he was one of the first Democrats to publicly oppose the war in Vietnam. Throughout his political career, he remained a professor of economics at Harvard University, where he is now professor emeritus. Galbraith's books have reached popular audiences, generations of students, as well as political insiders. His books include American Capitalism, The Affluent Society, and The New Industrial State. A new book on economic history titled Economics in Perspective has just been published by Houghton Mifflin. John Kenneth Galbraith will celebrate his 79th birthday next week. He came of age during the Depression, and he told me how those years impressed upon him the need for and the importance of good economic planning.
I was studying agriculture in Ontario, in Canada. In fact, I've often said that I'm the only senior member of the Harvard faculty with a first degree in animal husbandry. And I reached the conclusion in those years that we could produce better and better farm products, higher and higher quality. But the real problem was whether they would sell or not, whether you could make a living producing them. So I shifted my attention on those grounds to economics. And it was a considerable decision. I've been involved with it ever since.
But I guess with the Depression, you could see economics as a life and death issue as opposed to as an academic discipline.
Yeah, that was true. And it was also quite wonderful. The autumn of 1934, I just finished taking my degree at Berkeley and was on the way to Harvard, which had just hired me, and I stopped for a few weeks, 3 or 4 months in Washington. Well, I stopped to see some of my old professors. And such wonderfully was the shortage of economists that I was put on the payroll the next day. And that was my first experience of government. I was put on the payroll, and in spite of the fact that I was a Canadian citizen and nobody asked me my citizenship, I did have to go to the top floor of the South Building of the Department of Agriculture and affirm that I was a Democrat. I had no difficulty doing that. And so that there was two sides. The Depression, and particularly the New Deal, created a strong market for members of my profession.
Well, from 1941 to 43, you became known as the economic czar in the Roosevelt administration. You were the deputy administrator of the Office of Price Controls. This was really one of your first chances to actually put your economic theory into practice. Did your theories work in practice during those years?
Well, I had some experiences before that. I'd made a major study of the whole public works program, which was published on approximately the same day as the fall of France, and sank into an obscurity from which it's never been rescued. But I was put in charge of organizing the price control system of the country in the spring of 1941. I discovered after I'd been in that job for a few months that the basic idea with which I'd come in, which was a kind of selective price control, would not work. And that one had to have a blanket overall control of prices. And I changed my mind with a minimum of difficulty.
That's interesting that you'd say that, because I would think it would be very difficult to change your own theory or to change your mind. People are always looking over your shoulder.
People weren't, as a matter of fact. And others were seeing the problem as I did. And I discovered on that one occasion that I had a certain measure of mental flexibility, at least when that was the practical thing to do. I held that job until 1943, by which time my enemies had far outnumbered my friends. And I must say that in terms of power, authority, responsibility, my life has been downhill ever since.
Do you mean that seriously?
Nothing. Oh, sure. I've never had anything like the responsibilities I carried at that time. Nothing.
You say that your enemies outnumbered your friends. What made you so unpopular?
I think possibly there was a natural, juvenile lack of tact, as I look back on it. I think I would be much more tactful now. I was only in my early 30s. But the much more serious problem was that everybody's price I fixed or we fixed, and every request for an increase that we denied made somebody or other bitterly anti-Galbraith. I think you can understand that, can't you?
Oh, sure.
If I fixed your, you know, really incredible salary as a public broadcaster, how would you feel about me?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly my opinion of you would be based on what salary you decided I should be getting. Absolutely. So people all across the country had strong opinions on the prices that you were setting.
Unquestionably. In those days, I got up every morning and looked at my calendar to see what congressional committee was investigating my abuse of power that day. You'd be surprised how many committees there were. Indeed, I was talking about this earlier today. I once calculated that as a result of that experience, and a considerable amount since, that I have in my life spent just under a year before congressional committees, somewhere in the neighborhood of 300. How is that for wasted time?
Well, you know, I think it was also during the period when you were the deputy administrator in the Office of Price Control that the FBI started.
Office of Price Administration.
I'm sorry.
See how much nicer that sounds.
Sounds much more neutral, doesn't it? Isn't that when the FBI started their dossier on you?
Well, I once wrote a piece for Esquire called My 40 Years with the FBI, which goes rather beyond the dossiers that in that quite marvelous piece of Herbert Mitgang's in the current New Yorker. I suppose it did. My impression, however, was that I became of more interest to the FBI in various subsequent posts or various subsequent activities. But I suppose actually there was an FBI investigation even at that early stage.
While we're on the subject, what most surprised you when you got your Freedom of Information Act file?
What most surprised me, well, there were three things. One was the cultural problem. FBI agents were struggling with issues which they really didn't understand. For example, you could figure out who was giving information by knowing who was the plausible person and counting the number of letters, even though the names were blacked out. And the FBI went to an old professorial colleague of mine at Princeton, who, a very conservative man, wanted to repeal the 20th century, and asked him about me and said, he said, well, Galbraith, he's very doctrinaire. But the poor FBI man heard that as Dr. Ware. And for the next 10 years, whenever I was up for some public post, there was some investigation, the file would say, he's under the influence of one Dr. Ware, otherwise unidentified. But the second thing was more surprising. And that, not surprising, really. It is what your friends would say about you. All of them, almost without exception, would say exactly what they thought would be most useful to you. Oh, Galbraith is very conservative. Galbraith is quite reactionary. An old professor at Harvard who was asked about me said, well, he's a little bit to the left, but nothing like Franklin D. Roosevelt. And so everybody would come quite bravely to your support and say things about you that you wouldn't like to hear in public about how, as I say, how conservative you were. And thirdly, am I going too far on this?
No, it's interesting.
Thirdly, there were times when it wasn't particularly flattering. Sometime in the 1950s, I gave some testimony before the House Senate Banking and Currency Committee, and the market took a terrific drop while I was testifying. And a senator from Indiana, said this was the action of a typical subversive, breaking the market this way. First time that it was ever considered subversive to bring about a stock market decline, I suppose. Then, in desperation, he went through an intermediary to J. Edgar Hoover to get some support for this proposition. And there was a great investigation. This is all in the file. Minute by minute, day by hour by hour, who they talked to. And finally, they came up with a conclusion, which must have been terribly disturbing to Senator Capehart. Said, our investigation shows that Professor Galbraith is arrogant, somewhat conceited, but not disloyal. In any other community, that would have been considered very disagreeable, but at that moment, it was a great exoneration.
Right. My guess is John Kenneth Galbraith, who, by the way, has written a new book titled Economics in Perspective. You were one of John F. Kennedy's earliest supporters, and you've described him as one of the few public men wholly satisfied with his personality. Would you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I remember going down to see him the week after the nomination, after we got back from Los Angeles in 1960. I went down with Arthur Schlesinger for a Sunday lunch. And marvelous comment. He said, the campaign is not going to be tiring for me because I can be myself. It's going to be quite tiring for Richard Nixon because he has a problem of his identity. But I don't have to think about that. And I think this was an extremely important characteristic of the president, that he was never plagiarizing himself. One of the extraordinary things about politics, and one of the depressing things about politics, is that political candidates, people in public life, began sooner or later, many of them, to imitate their own public image, their own television image, or how they're described in the papers, in the press. As I say, they plagiarize themselves. This is something that Kennedy never did. One consequence was that there was a certain candor, a certain marvelous candor in his speech, which was just extraordinarily refreshing.
He made you ambassador to India. Why didn't he keep you around as an economic advisor?
I think on the whole, he preferred to have me in India. I'm quite tall, as you know. I have no particular talent for anonymity. And people around the White House are meant to keep out of sight. And I think that Kennedy had grave doubts as to whether I could be there in secret. The other thing was that I had just that spring published, it was the spring before, my dates were wrong. I just published a year before The Affluent Society, which had got a great deal of attention, I'm happy to say, and which could have, if my appearance in Washington, could have committed the president to ideas which were perhaps a bit ahead of their time, or maybe wrong, for that matter.
Yeah, so you might have been a little too controversial to keep around.
I was a little too controversial. I don't like to say they were wrong. Let me just say they were ahead of their time.
My guest is economist, best-selling author, and Harvard professor John Kenneth Galbraith. His new book is titled Economics in Perspective, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist John Kenneth Galbraith is my guest. You were one of the first liberal Democrats to publicly oppose the war in Vietnam. Did you try to work behind the scenes before going public about your opposition?
Oh, sure. Kennedy sent me out to Saigon in the autumn of 1961, knowing that I had some doubts about the war, and hoping, I think really hoping, that he would get the kind of report that he thought I might make. And I, it was a very short trip, and I suppose maybe I had my mind partly made up in advance. I knew that part of the world somewhat better than some of the people in Washington. And I concluded then that it was a hopeless exercise, that we were being regarded not as defenders of democracy, but as another interventionist force, as the French had been, as the Japanese had been, and as for many centuries the Chinese had been, and that we were in association with a government that was not considered tolerable by its own people, which had the strong opposition of the whole Buddhist community. And so I came back, and for the next several years, in association with Kennedy and with Lyndon Johnson, a man whom I greatly admired, I argued against the intervention there, made various proposals as to how we might negotiate or get out. And then I eventually decided that my desire to be in, my desire to have a close association with Washington, was getting the better of my better judgment. So I went public, started making speeches against the war, joined up with Gene McCarthy.
What were some of the difficulties of publicly opposing friends and colleagues, which is what you had to do?
I felt very badly about it. I think I can say that Lyndon Johnson and I were at one time very good friends. We're the same age. We both came into Washington, that milieu from rural backgrounds. And he rightly, you can understandably, expected his friends in a difficult time to come to his support. And I didn't. And that hurt me, and it, I think, well, there was no doubt that it hurt him, too. He didn't like it a bit. So I found it a very disagreeable thing. And also, I had a lot of other friends who were identified with the war, had become involved in a kind of incrementalism. That's a rather formidable word, but let me explain. It's very important. They... easy course, the tempting course, is always to say just a little more, not to change course, not to pull out, but to say, if we just do this, if we just do this, if we do just a little more of this, a few more troops and so forth, then we think we're on the way out. Whereas the person who says, look, for goodness sakes, let's call a halt, sounds rather irresponsible. He's drastic. So that the whole temptation is to stay on course. And incidentally, that very phrase, stay on course, sounds rather good, doesn't it?
Right, I know what you mean by the incrementalism, because a little bit and a little bit adds up to a lot over time.
That is right.
Did you feel that having a home base at Harvard University helped you to be intellectually honest, because you didn't have to depend on Washington for a livelihood or for a vehicle to express your opinions?
Well, one should always be extremely suspicious of anybody who praises his own intellectual honesty. I have made compromises. I've always also, particularly as ambassador, became expert in the art of self-censorship. You kind of run a computer program through your mind as to what the Congress will say, what the President will say, what the State Department will say, what the government to which you're accredited will say, and the consequence is that you have a censorship which is marvelously designed to keep you from saying anything interesting at all. But on your main point, there's absolutely no question. The ideal situation in Washington is to be able to take the next plane out of town.
Right.
Whatever your inner courage, the knowledge that you can do that enormously reinforces it.
John Kenneth Galbraith is my guest, and by the way, he's written a new book titled Economics in Perspective. You once wrote that one of the perils of our age is that the gravest decisions must be made by tired people, and you were referring to presidents and the presidential staff. How did you see that problem manifest itself?
Oh, very often, one would get a decision. This was certainly true in the State Department, where I had two tours of duty, from meetings where everybody had reached the point where any decision was better than just continuing the discussion, and where the fatigue had been the circumstance that forced the result. And that was what I had in mind there, and I think this is true in business. I think it's true of faculty meetings. I think very often the decision is taken not because people think it is right, but because the participants are so tired that they can't go on.
We know, in keeping on the subject of fatigue, you also wrote that when you worked for Kennedy, that you both used prescription sleeping pills because it was so difficult to unwind and fall asleep after the tensions of the day. Did that have consequences? Did it leave you tired the next day or a little dull from having...
Oh, unquestionably. There was, in moments of great tension, I mean, I don't want to be wrong here, or give the wrong impression. Somebody described being an ambassador like being the pilot of an airplane. Hours of boredom and moments of panic. And so there were many, many hours, many days when as ambassador I was under no strain whatever. I did a certain amount of writing in those days. But then, as in the autumn of 1962, when India and China fell out in that border war over some territory in the Himalayas that you could only hope would belong to somebody else, the whole burden of that responsibility fell on me because it also coincided with the missile crisis in the Caribbean. And this poses the problem. Either you stay awake and are tired the next day, or you take a sleeping pill and you're slightly fuzzy the next day. And what is worse, about an hour after you've taken the damn pill, the telephone rings or somebody comes in and you have to get up and handle some business.
Which you're not prepared to do because you're under the influence of the sleeping pill.
And you're possibly a menace to public order and stability because you're still half asleep.
Has this been one of the hidden problems of politics, do you think?
I don't know. Since I wrote about it in that journal that I kept in India, it hasn't been exactly a secret in my life.
I'd like to quote something that this is from the opening paragraph of your book, The Affluent Society. You wrote, "Until a rich man learns to live with his wealth, he will have a well-observed tendency to put it to the wrong purposes or otherwise to make himself foolish." I'd imagine that you really got a lot of money from the bestsellers that you had, and I wonder if you ever feared that you'd be using money that you accumulated for the wrong purposes.
Well, I didn't. There wasn't all that much. I'm not saying that I've ever lived in stark, grim poverty, but you'd be surprised at how many books you can write and how much and how little you have after... Among the other things, after taxes, I've never resorted to tax shelters and that sort of thing. But I've never had such a feeling. I've tried to be rather supportive of a certain number of causes, but I've never had any sense of guilt over the support that I accorded my wife, my sons, or in some cases, my friends.
You grew up on a farm, and the way you've told it in your autobiography, you were thrilled to get out, and you really didn't take to the farm chores very well. You've been through very difficult positions because of the... You've been through difficult times because of the great decisions that you've had to make and because of all the tension associated with having to make really important decisions. When things got really hard, did you ever find yourself thinking, well, but at least thank God I'm not on a farm. I've been able to live a life of the mind and a life involved with politics.
Well, let me make 2 points. First, I don't really think I've ever been under that much tension. There were 2 periods in my life when I felt really deeply, terribly pressed and involved. One of them was in the autumn of 1962 in India, and the other I've already mentioned was when I was running the running price control. But other than that, I've lived a generally somewhat relaxed life. I don't want to give the impression that I've been harried. But let me tell you, my dear, I have never awakened once in my life without a murmur of thanks that I didn't have a day's work ahead of me on that Ontario farm. The escape from manual labor is something which no one should underestimate. It is the major objective of a very large number of people, and I was one.
You have a birthday coming up on October 15th. Can I get on the act early and wish you a happy birthday?
Oh, how very nice of you.
Well, John Kenneth Galbraith, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Well, it's a great pleasure being here. I'm a great defender of National Public Radio, as you know.
That's great, and we all appreciate it. Thank you for being with us. My guest has been John Kenneth Galbraith. His new book is titled Economics in Perspective, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. He's an economist, a best-selling author, and a Harvard professor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.